In the pension Orfila that afternoon, I went to the library, and there, after bathing in the Ganges and pondering over the signs of the zodiac, I began to reflect on the meaning of that inferno which Strindberg had so mercilessly depicted. And as I ruminated, it began to grow clear to me, the mystery of his pilgrimage, the flight which the poet makes over the face of the earth, and then, as if he had been ordained to reenact a lost drama, the heroic descent to the very bowels of the earth, the dark and fearsome sojourn in the belly of the whale, the bloody struggle to liberate himself, to emerge clean of the past, a bright, gory sun god cast up on an alien shore. It was no mystery to me any longer why he and others, Dante, Rabelais, Van Gogh, etc., etc., had made their pilgrimage to Paris. I understood then why it is that Paris attracts the tortured, the hallucinated, the great maniacs of love. I understood why it is that here, at the very hub of the wheel, one can embrace the most fantastic, the most impossible theories without finding them in the least strange. It is here that one reads again the books of his youth, and the enigmas take on new meanings, one for every white hair. One walks the streets knowing that he is mad, possessed, because it is only too obvious that these cold, indifferent faces are the visages of one's keepers. Here all boundaries fade away, and the world reveals itself for the mad slaughterhouse that it is. The treadmill stretches away to infinitude, the hatches are closed down tight, logic runs rampant with bloody cleaver flashing. The air is chill and stagnant, the language apocalyptic. Not an exit sign anywhere, no issue save death. A blind alley at the end of which is a scaffold. An eternal city, Paris. More eternal than Rome, more splendorous than Nineveh. The very navel of the world, to which, like a blind and faltering idiot, one crawls back on hands and knees. And like a cork that has drifted to the dead center of the ocean, one floats here in the scum and rack of the seas, listless, hopeless, heedless even of a passing Columbus. The cradles of civilization are the putrid sinks of the world, the charnel house to which the stinking wombs confide their bloody packages of flesh and bone. The streets were my refuge, and no man can understand the glamour of the streets until he is obliged to take refuge in them, until he has become a straw that is tossed here and there by every zephyr that blows. One passes along a street on a wintry day, and seeing a dog for sale, one is moved to tears. While across the way, cheerful as a cemetery, stands a miserable hut that calls itself Hôtel du Tombeau des Lapins. That makes one laugh. Laugh fit to die. Until one notices that there are hotels everywhere, for rabbits, dogs, lice, emperors, cabinet ministers, pawnbrokers, horse knackers, and so on. And almost every other one is an Hôtel de l'Avenir, which makes one more hysterical still. So many hotels of the future. No hotels in the past participle, no subjunctive modes, no conjunctivitis. Everything is hoary, grisly, bristling with merriment, swollen with the future, like a gumboil. Drunk with this lecherous eczema of the future, I stagger over to the Place Violet, the colors all mauve and slate, the doorways so low that only dwarfs and goblins could hobble in. Over the dull cranium of Zola, the chimneys are belching pure coke, while the Madonna of sandwiches listens with cabbage ears to the bubbling of the gas tanks, those beautiful bloated toads which squat by the roadside. Why do I suddenly recollect the Passage des Thermopylées? Because that day a woman addressed her puppy in the apocalyptic language of the slaughterhouse, and the little bitch, she understood what this greasy slut of a midwife was saying. How that depressed me. More even than the sight of those whimpering curs that were being sold on the Rue Brancion. Because it was not the dogs which filled me so with pity, but the huge iron railing, those rusty spikes which seemed to stand between me and my rightful life. In the pleasant little lane, near the Abattoir de Vaugirard, Abattoir Hippovagique, which is called the Rue des Perichots, I had noticed here and there signs of blood. Justice Strindberg in his madness had recognized omens and portents in the very flagging of the Pension Orfila, so as I wandered aimlessly through this muddy lane bespattered with blood, fragments of the past detached themselves and floated listlessly before my eyes, taunting me with the direst forebodings. I saw my own blood being spilled, the muddy road stained with it, as far back as I could remember, from the very beginning, doubtless. One is ejected into the world like a dirty little mummy. The roads are slippery with blood, and no one knows why it should be so. Each one is traveling his own way, and though the earth be rotting with good things, there is no time to pluck the fruits. The procession scrambles toward the exit sign, and such a panic is there, such a sweat to escape, that the weak and the helpless are trampled into the mud, and their cries are unheard. My world of human beings had perished. I was utterly alone in the world, and for friends I had the streets, and the streets spoke to me in that sad, bitter language compounded of human misery, yearning, regret, failure, wasted effort. Passing under the viaduct along the Rue Broca, one night after I had been informed that Mona was ill and starving, I suddenly recalled that it was here in the squalor and gloom of this sunken street, terrorized perhaps by a premonition of the future, that Mona clung to me, and with a quivering voice begged me to promise that I would never leave her, never, no matter what happened. And only a few days later, I stood on the platform of the Gare Saint-Lazare, and I watched the train pull out, the train that was bearing her away. She was leaning out of the window, just as she had leaned out of the window when I left her in New York, and there was that same sad, inscrutable smile on her face, that last-minute look which is intended to convey so much, but which is only a mask that is twisted by a vacant smile. Only a few days before, she had clung to me desperately, and then something happened, something which is not even clear to me now, and of her own volition, she boarded the train, and she was looking at me again with that sad, enigmatic smile which baffles me, which is unjust, unnatural, which I distrust with all my soul. And now it is I, standing in the shadow of the viaduct, who reach out for her, who cling to her desperately, and there is that same inexplicable smile on my lips, the mask that I have clamped down over my grief. I can stand here and smile vacantly, and no matter how fervid my prayers, no matter how desperate my longing, there is an ocean between us. There she will stay and starve, and here I shall walk from one street to the next, the hot tears scalding my face. It is that sort of cruelty which is embedded in the streets. It is that which stares out from the walls and terrifies us when suddenly we respond to a nameless fear, when suddenly our souls are invaded by a sickening panic. It is that which gives the lampposts their ghoulish twists, which makes them beckon to us and lure us to their strangling grip. It is that which makes certain houses appear like the guardians of secret crimes, and their blind windows like the empty sockets of eyes that have seen too much. It is that sort of thing, written into the human physiognomy of the streets, which makes me flee when overhead I suddenly see inscribed, Impasse Satan. That which makes me shudder when at the very entrance to the mosque I observe that it is written, Mondays and Thursdays, tuberculosis, Wednesdays and Fridays, syphilis. In every metro station there are grinning skulls that greet you with, Défendez-vous contre le syphilis. Wherever there are walls, there are posters with bright, venomous crabs heralding the approach of cancer. No matter where you go, no matter what you touch, there is cancer and syphilis. It is written in the sky. It flames and dances like an evil portent. It has eaten into our souls, and we are nothing but a dead thing, like the moon. I think it was the 4th of July when they took the chair from under my ass again. Not a word of warning. One of the big muckamucks from the other side of the water had decided to make economies. Cutting down on proofreaders and helpless little dactylos enabled him to pay the expenses of his trips back and forth and the palatial quarters he occupied at the Ritz. After paying what little debts I had accumulated among the linotype operators and a goodwill token at the bistro across the way, in order to preserve my credit, there was scarcely anything left out of my final pay. I had to notify the patron of the hotel that I would be leaving, I didn't tell him why, because he'd have worried about his measly 200 francs. "What'll you do if you lose your job?" That was the phrase that rang in my ears continually. Ça y est maintenant. Ausgespielt. Nothing to do but to get down into the street again. Walk, hang around, sit on benches, kill time. By now, of course, my face was familiar in Montparnasse. For a while I could pretend that I was still working on the paper. That would make it a little easier to bum a breakfast or a dinner. It was summertime, and the tourists were pouring in. I had schemes up my sleeve for mulcting them. What'll you do? Well, I wouldn't starve, that's one thing. If I should do nothing else but concentrate on food, that would prevent me from falling to pieces. For a week or two, I could still go to Monsieur Paul's and have a square meal every evening. He wouldn't know whether I was working or not. The main thing is to eat. Trust to Providence for the rest. Naturally, I kept my ears open for anything that sounded like a little dough, and I cultivated a whole new set of acquaintances, bores whom I had sedulously avoided heretofore, drunks whom I loathed, artists who had a little money, Guggenheim prize men, etc. It's not hard to make friends when you squat on a terrasse 12 hours a day. You get to know every sot in Montparnasse. They cling to you like lice, even if you have nothing to offer them but your ears. Now that I'd lost my job, Carl and Van Norden had a new phrase for me. What if your wife should arrive now? Well, what of it? 2 mouths to feed instead of one. I'd have a companion in misery. And if she hadn't lost her good looks, I'd probably do better in double harness than alone. The world never permits a good-looking woman to starve. Tanya I couldn't depend on to do much for me. She was sending money to Sylvester. I had thought at first that she might let me share her room, but she was afraid of compromising herself. Besides, she had to be nice to her boss. The first people to turn to when you're down and out are the Jews. I had 3 of them on my hands almost at once, sympathetic souls. One of them was a retired fur merchant who had an itch to see his name in the papers. He proposed that I write a series of articles under his name for a Jewish daily in New York. I had to scout around the Dome and the Coupole, searching for prominent Jews. The first man I picked on was a celebrated mathematician. He couldn't speak a word of English. I had to write about the theory of shock from the diagrams he left on the paper napkins. I had to describe the movements of the astral bodies and demolish the Einsteinian conception at the same time. All for 25 francs. When I saw my articles in the newspaper, I couldn't read them, but they looked impressive just the same, especially with the pseudonym of the fur merchant attached. I did a lot of pseudonymous writing during this period. When the big new whorehouse opened up on the Boulevard Edgar Quinet, I got a little rake-off for writing the pamphlets. That is to say, a bottle of champagne and a free fuck in one of the Egyptian rooms. If I succeeded in bringing a client, I was to get my commission, just like Kepi got his in the old days. One night I brought Van Norden. He was going to let me earn a little money by enjoying himself upstairs. But when the Madame learned that he was a newspaper man, she wouldn't hear of taking money from him. It was a bottle of champagne again, and a free fuck. I got nothing out of it. As a matter of fact, I had to write the story for him, because he couldn't think how to get round the subject without mentioning the kind of place it was. One thing after another like that. I was getting fucked good and proper. The worst job of all was a thesis I undertook to write for a deaf and dumb psychologist. A treatise on the care of crippled children. My head was full of diseases and braces and workbenches and fresh air theories. It took about 6 weeks, off and on, and then, to rub it in, I had to proofread the goddamn thing. It was in French, such a French as I've never in my life seen or heard. But it brought me in a good breakfast every day. An American breakfast, with orange juice, oatmeal, cream, coffee, now and then ham and eggs for a change. It was the only period of my Paris days that I ever indulged in a decent breakfast, thanks to the crippled children of Rockaway Beach, the East Side, and all the coves and inlets bordering on these sore points. Then one day I fell in with a photographer. He was making a collection of the slimy joints of Paris for some degenerate in Munich. He wanted to know if I would pose for him with my pants down, and in other ways. I thought of those skinny little runts who look like bellhops and messenger boys that one sees on pornographic postcards in little bookshop windows occasionally, the mysterious phantoms who inhabit the Rue de la Lune and other malodorous quarters of the city. I didn't like very much the idea of advertising my physiog in the company of these elite. But since I was assured that the photographs were for a strictly private collection, and since it was destined for Munich, I gave my consent. When you're not in your hometown, you can permit yourself little liberties, particularly for such a worthy motive as earning your daily bread. After all, I hadn't been so squeamish, come to think of it, even in New York. There were nights when I was so damn desperate back there that I had to go out right in my own neighborhood and panhandle. We didn't go to the show places familiar to the tourists, but to the little joints where the atmosphere was more congenial, where we could play a game of cards in the afternoon before getting down to work. He was a good companion, the photographer. He knew the city inside out, the walls particularly. He talked to me about Goethe often, and the days of the Hohenstaufen, and the massacre of the Jews during the reign of the Black Death. Interesting subjects, and always related in some obscure way to the things he was doing. He had ideas for scenarios, too, astounding ideas, but nobody had the courage to execute them. The sight of a horse split open like a saloon door would inspire him to talk of Dante, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Rembrandt. From the slaughterhouse at Villette, he would jump into a cab and rush me to the Trocadero Museum in order to point out a skull or a mummy that had fascinated him. We explored the 5th, the 13th, the 19th, and the 20th arrondissement thoroughly. Our favorite resting places were lugubrious little spots, such as the Place Nationale, Place des Peupliers, Place de la Contrescarpe, Place Paul Verlaine. Many of these places were already familiar to me, but all of them I now saw in a different light, owing to the rare flavor of his conversation. If today I should happen to stroll down to the Rue du Château des Rentiers, for example, inhaling the fetid stench of the hospital beds with which the 13th arrondissement reeks, my nostrils would undoubtedly expand with pleasure, because compounded with that odor of stale piss and formaldehyde, there would be the odors of our imaginative voyages through the charnel house of Europe, which the Black Death had created. Through him, I got to know a spiritual-minded individual named Kruger, who was a sculptor and painter. Kruger took a shine to me for some reason or other. It was impossible to get away from him once he discovered that I was willing to listen to his esoteric ideas. There are people in this world for whom the word esoteric seems to act as a divine ichor, like settled for Herr Peeperkorn of the Magic Mountain. Kruger was one of those saints who have gone wrong, a masochist, an anal type whose law is scrupulousness, rectitude, and conscientiousness, who on an off day would knock a man's teeth down his throat without a qualm. He seemed to think I was ripe to move on to another plane, a higher plane, as he put it. I was ready to move on to any plane he designated, provided that one didn't eat less or drink less. He chewed my head off about the thread soul, the causal body, ablation, the Upanishads, Plotinus, Krishnamurti, the karmic vestiture of the soul, the nirvanic consciousness, all that flapdoodle which blows out of the east like a breath from the plague. Sometimes he would go into a trance and talk about his previous incarnations, how he imagined them to be at least. Or he would relate his dreams, which, so far as I could see, were thoroughly insipid, prosaic, hardly worth even the attention of a Freudian, but for him, there were vast esoteric marvels hidden in their depths, which I had to aid him to decipher. He had turned himself inside out, like a coat whose nap is worn off. Little by little, as I gained his confidence, I wormed my way into his heart. I had him at such a point that he would come running after me in the street to inquire if he could lend me a few francs. He wanted to hold me together in order to survive the transition to a higher plane. I acted like a pear that is ripening on the tree. Now and then I had relapses, and I would confess my need for more earthly nourishment. A visit to the Sphinx, or the Rue Saint-Apolline, where I knew he repaired in weak moments when the demands of the flesh had become too vehement. As a painter, he was nil. As a sculptor, less than nil. He was a good housekeeper, that I'll say for him, and an economical one to boot. Nothing went to waste, not even the paper that the meat was wrapped in. Friday nights he threw open his studio to his fellow artists. There was always plenty to drink and good sandwiches, and if by chance there was anything left over, I would come round the next day to polish it off. Back of the Bal Bullier was another studio I got into the habit of frequenting, the studio of Mark Swift. If he was not a genius, he was certainly an eccentric, this caustic Irishman. He had for a model a Jewess, whom he had been living